This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on April 25th, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
As I told the kids, I banged the gavel and the meeting comes to order. The Federal Election Commission open meeting of Thursday, April 25th will now come to order. My apologies to everyone who was waiting and also to all the children who maybe were going to listen in and got bored waiting. We had a few last-minute edits, but I think we're going to be able to do some business this morning, so that's a good thing. It is Take Your Kids to Work Day at the FEC, so we've got a lot of kids in the building, and we're happy to have them. And it is still April, still Autism Awareness Month, so I continue to wear my Autism Awareness ribbon for my son. Unfortunately, all of my kids are too old to come to Take Your Kids to Work Day anymore. We have an amended agenda, and we will start with correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move adoption of the minutes, agenda document number 13-13, minutes from the open meeting of Thursday, April 11, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes for the open meeting of April 11, 2013, as set forth in agenda document number 13-13. Is there any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? And the motion carries 5-0. Now, the first item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2012-38, the Socialist Workers Party, but that is the document that we've been editing. So we will get to the Socialist Workers Party in a few minutes, but we're going to start with 2013-02. We have late submitted documents. Mr. Vice Chairman, do we have a motion for late submitted documents? And then I guess we're going to need another motion because we're going to have an even later submitted document.
I move we suspend the rules regarding timely submission of documents since we have late submitted documents. I don't have my standard language, but I think that sufficiently carries the point.
Okay. The Vice Chairman has moved that we waive the rules on the timely submission of agenda documents so that we may consider, let's see, what do we got submitted late? Agenda document.
Thank you. That's
okay. That's okay. I know this is what you meant to say. Do we have 1307-A yet? So
no, ma'am.
Okay, so should we wait to include that in the motion?
It's coming, so if you'd like to just do it in one
fell
swoop,
I don't see why not. Can we do it when we don't have it in front of us? Okay, so all right. So the motion includes Agenda Document 13-07-A, Agenda Document 13-15, Agenda Document 13-14. Did I miss any late submitted documents? Okay. Does everybody understand the motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Okay, now we will begin our consideration of Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-02 submitted by Dan Winslow by Craig Engel. And Mr. Engel was in the room. Mr. Engel still in the room? Come on, Mr. Engel, have a seat. We might have some questions for you. But we will begin with Ms. Selenkoff from the Office of the General Counsel.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Agenda Document 13-15 contains two drafts that respond to an advisory opinion request by Dan Winslow. Mr. Winslow is a candidate for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, April 30th, special primary election next week. Mr. Winslow asks whether his committee may apply the spouse contribution rule at 11 CFR 110.1I to contributions it receives from lawfully married same-sex couples. Drafts A and B both conclude that the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, requires the Commission to conclude that the committee may not apply the regulation to contributions from spouses who are not of the opposite sex. The Office of General Counsel requests authority to make technical and conforming changes to the final draft. And the commission received four comments on the request and one comment on the drafts. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. And just in case people were confused, we put out a couple of drafts late in the day yesterday. We were in the process of trying to harmonize drafts, and I think several commissioners felt like we really needed to get something out on the public record by close of business yesterday. So we kind of put out what we had ready to go at that point and continued to work on coming to some joint conclusion. So that's... With these 20-day AOs, time is compressed, and sometimes we have to do things a little bit more on the fly. Do we have any questions for counsel or Mr. Engel or any discussion on the draft or drafts? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me begin by commenting on some of the comments, which are always helpful. One that caught my eye was filed by Scott Knox, and he makes the point that given that the issue of the Defense of Marriage Act's constitutionality is currently before the Supreme Court, that perhaps the commission shouldn't adopt an opinion at this time or extend the deadline for the comments or whatnot. I think that makes perfect sense, but for the statute, when someone comes in and asks for an AO, we have to issue an AO in the statutory timelines on this, and we have to answer the question, regardless of what else may be happening in the world. So I think it's a good suggestion, but I don't think we have the power to tread water while the Supreme Court considers an issue, because at the end of the day, the circuit in which the requester comes from, that's the case really before the Supreme Court. That court had struck DOMA, but that decision, as I understand it, has been stayed. So there's not a binding precedent, which brings us to the issue at hand. To me, this is an FEC issue, and the issue is contribution limits and the rather technical regs the commission has promulgated regarding how campaigns and contributors who give money to campaigns get split up if it's a joint bank account check or whatnot, and it all tied to the contribution limits. So let me state the threshold that there's no question that everyone has their own contribution limit, and there's no issue there. The issue as posed, I think, and this is going to be a question for the requester, I think is posed by the requester, is whether 110.1i permits a campaign to treat a same-sex couple who's married under state law, recognized by state law, as a spouse for purposes of the regulatory language. And the problem is, in one of the, with all due respect to the other, to the Congress, one of the rare fits of clarity, the Defense of Marriage Act is remarkably clear, and it says for purposes of federal law, regardless of what state law says, spouse means what the federal law says it means. And in this case, if you're a same-sex married couple, you're not a spouse for purposes of, I would think, the FEC rule. In fact, the requester has filed a joint amicus brief with the Supreme Court, makes this very point. So I guess the my question is really twofold. One, I think we all agree what the answer is, and I think we agree that we just can't disregard DOMA, regardless of what anyone may think about it on its merits. We're here to do what we do, which is take the law as passed. But two, many requesters are happy with a yes no matter how they get there. Here, in the initial request, you invoked, I believe in the original request, revoked 110.1K, which is, of course, after I. And here, if it comes from a joint account, regardless of marital status, a campaign can still split the money up, so to speak. So whether or not one is a spouse for purposes of the one reg and DOMA and all that, to me, doesn't really matter much for purposes of campaign finance law, because since 1987, the reg has said effectively a yes to your question. Now, there may be a reason why it's been narrowed, but I'm a little confused as to what particularly is in front of the commission, and this is not the first time I've raised this, where I see a request that seems to get narrowed as time goes on and when you work with the Office of General Counsel, and that it becomes a much more narrow question. So given that I'm seeing an amicus brief, which essentially already answers this question, that DOMA would trump state law, but yet I see a reg that gets you a pathway to yes, what, as a commissioner, am I to do here?
Well, on the amicus brief, that brief was not submitted by the requester here. So
you're correct. I apologize. You're here as counsel for the requester. That brief, I think, was in your individual capacity.
That is correct.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that joint contributions take a variety of different forms. Sometimes you see two names on a check. Sometimes you see one name on a check. And sometimes you see follow-up paperwork, and sometimes you don't. So there are a lot of different factual situations that we face out in the field. And there are probably three different factual situations that we're grappling with here. But the most important one being, regardless of whether or not we have a joint contribution or joint names on a check or one name on a check, you have a regulation that talks about spouses. And that was our question. Can we rely upon that regulation for checks that come from a spouse, regardless of how the payor on the check appears? So the question is, I know, a difficult one, and the requester understands the answer that we're seeing here. We were all anxiously awaiting draft C, which we didn't see, but
perhaps the Chief Justice has it prepared.
But it's the opinion of the requester that sometimes what's right isn't lawful yet. And although the requester is planning on depositing these contributions and sorting them out later, we may also be coming back later, as one of the drafts suggests, to see if there is any additional analysis that the commission could provide after the Supreme Court rules in a definitive way. The requester understands also that there's a big difference between policy decisions and law, and who makes the policy decisions and then who implements the law after those policy decisions are made. You know, he intends to respect as many of the contribution decisions as his donors have, and he wants to treat all of his donors equally. He also understands that it's not the commission's job to find ways for people to make contributions. And your job isn't to necessarily encourage additional money in politics, but it is, you know, your job to tell us what to do as best as you can. And in this particular case, you have, and you did quickly. And I do want to commend your counsel's office for how quickly they were able to be in touch with us within hours after the request was docketed to ask a couple of questions, and then also for your agency to, as the commissioner noted, get an answer out very quickly. It's not the answer that we wanted. We understand that there are some alternatives that we have with some versions of checks. We are going to work as best we can with this, but we do want, you know, our donors to know that we're going to continue to work for them.
Just one follow-up. Is there any other answer other than the answer that the ultimate conclusion both drafts come to? I mean, looking at the law, I understand your position is it's a tough question, but as a legal question, it seemed unfortunately or unfortunately, depending on one's perspective, as a decision maker, clear questions are always usually welcome, regardless of the unfortunate result. Maybe,
right.
As a leading practitioner in this area, so I don't see another way. Unless we look at the regs as a whole, we get 110.1K, effectively seems to
well remember
seems to do this, but in the more narrow 110.1i, when you put it up against DOMA, do we have any other option here?
Well, Commissioner, I would note that much of the instigation of this request comes from donors, sometimes first-time donors, who are not as well adept in the understanding of campaign finance law as we all are and maybe sometimes take for granted. And when they look at a situation and then say, you know, we're a spouse and the spouses next door seem to be doing something, can we? And when we look at the history of the Federal Election Commission, and you have some great advisory opinions that talk about how you defer to state law when you have questions of state law, that those state laws can be helpful. And you also have a nice balance of decisions where you defer to other areas of the federal law when statutes and definitions of other parts of federal law can be very helpful. Those are often in cases where you can look at the IRS code or the Department of Transportation or Fair Labor Standards Act, where you're seeing some very, very specific, you know, guidance in other federal agencies that are very easy maybe to borrow here. We've not seen necessarily a situation where you have a statute that makes a rather, you know, broad pronouncement. And we're all very curious as to how broad that pronouncement is and how it really applies, and does it, you know, work with state law or does it trump state law? And the donors here saw a regulation that says spouses are allowed to do something, and we're spouses and we'd like to do that, and we'd like to do that because of that particular regulation. And I wasn't able to answer that question as to whether or not they could rely upon that regulation, because at bottom, whether this is a policy question or not, everyone wants to do something that's lawful, and they want to know what their rights are. Sometimes those are hard questions. Sometimes they're a mix of policy and law and federalism, and sometimes they belong to the courts, and sometimes they belong to agencies. But what belonged to the donors and to the candidate was an answer, and you were able to provide one, and a very clear one, with a couple of nice pieces of guidance and a footnote as well. And that's what we're going to have to work with. And we're going to work with that in the field. And we're going to work with these donations and with our donors. And as I said, we hope to be back.
So is that agreement with the gist of my question? There's no other way to go here when you look at where we are?
Not necessarily. I mean, I am not a constitutional lawyer in the sense that I can balance federalism in one particular statute against another particular statute. I would say this, is that we understand the answer, and we know how we're going to have to work with it, but we also understand that there is another answer that's possible, maybe not at this moment, but hopefully equally likely in the future.
Okay. I appreciate those comments and the recognition of the footnote, because when you read 110.1K, that talks about joint accounts and whether one's a spouse or not. DOMA doesn't affect that reg whatsoever. So take the hypothetical, if you have two married couples in Massachusetts living next to each other and the one couple says, gee, the other couple can do that, are we spouses too? Well, I would say 110.K moots that whole issue, and the answer is they are being treated the same for purposes of campaign finance law.
With a joint account.
Right.
But if you see spouses that don't have joint accounts, where the account is in the name of just one of the spouses, you might have a different answer. And when, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Jones are able to do one thing and Mr. and Mr. Jones are not, because of the way in which they hold their money, then there's confusion in the field, and that's what we're trying to, clear up. Again, you know, there's a great, great question of equity here, and we understand that the commission's job is not always to find the equities in a situation, but to just give us guidance. And there are a lot of different factual situations out there. There are civil unions and married couples and joint accounts and single accounts. And what we have is a situation where we have a variety of accounts and a variety of donors, and they want to know what they have to do. It would be unfortunate that in order to make the sort of contribution that some spouses have, that donors would have to reorganize their money, create joint accounts that may or may not be viewed as marital property under the particular laws of a particular state. And I think that that was part of the difficulty, is saying, does the way in which money is held make a difference here as to whether or not you can rely upon a spousal regulation or a joint regulation? We have some situations where we do have joint accounts, and we have some situations where we don't. You know, the requester wants to be able to respect all of his donors and, of course, raise as much money as he can. And we're going to have to work with this particular answer, and we intend to follow it. But we also intend to watch this very carefully, you know, treat our donors with as much equality as we can, respect their wishes, deposit as much of their contributions as we can, and hopefully give a very, very, you know, clear and maybe more definitive answer in the future when there are more definitive answers by courts.
Mr. Engel, first of all, I should say publicly that Mr. Engel did call me and give me a heads up that this request was coming in. It was not formally an ex parte at that point because there wasn't anything in front of us, but in the interest of full disclosure, I feel like I should say publicly that we did have a conversation. Mr. Engel, sometimes the law is an ass. This is a very difficult, in some ways it's very easy, and in some ways it's very difficult. It's personally a very difficult AO for me to vote for, and I'm going to have to sign it, too, because I'm the chair. I join wholeheartedly in the sentiments of one of the commenters who said they support marriage equality and believe that same-sex couples, like all Americans, are entitled to equal treatment under the law. My job here as a, not as a lawmaker, not as a judge, but as an administrator, is to take the law that I've got and apply it. And unfortunately, I don't think the law gives me any choice. DOMA says that for the purposes of federal law, this is what a spouse is, and we're applying a federal law. So I just don't see any way out. I'm hoping that this is really a very narrow problem that only affects a very small number of people, because I know a great many couples, gay, straight couples, where, you know, one part of the couple, one half of the couple contributes most of the income, and the other half of the couple may be managing the household and taking care of kids, and usually that actually is the person who's got the checkbook. I don't know too many. I know a lot of couples where only one person is providing the most of the financial resources, but I know very few couples where there's somebody that doesn't actually have a checkbook that's got their name on it.
Right.
So I'm hoping that this is, you know, sort of an anachronistic regulation for all kinds of couples and therefore won't have broad application, because as the vice chairman points out, it's under Section K, subsection K, any couple that has a joint account, they can use that. And the commission has not historically and is not going to start inquiring into, you know, who made the last deposit into the bank account. We're not getting into people's family finances and how they order that. And I think in some ways that responds to one of the other commenters who suggested that the commission could declare through an advisory opinion that contribution limitations apply separately to two individuals who share a residence and bank account. I think we actually have a regulation on point, and the footnote, which we're going to offer a small amendment to, makes clear that that section does apply to exactly that situation.
Right.
And people who share a residence, people who share a residence in a bank account or can use that bank account to make contributions. And again, agreeing with the vice chairman, of course, every individual has their own separate contribution limit. I wanted to make one other comment about another commenter. We did get a comment late last night that asked us to address several other issues. It was an interesting comment, and he raises interesting issues. That one was from Mr. Backer. But those weren't the questions that you asked.
Right.
So we would be happy to address his questions if he chooses to submit his own advisory opinion request, but he can't piggyback on top of yours and say, oh, while you're answering Mr. Engel's questions, could you answer a couple that I've got? Happy to address them, but I don't think we can do it here. I share your hope that we will be in a position to provide you with a different answer at some point in the near future, and I hope at that time you'll come back and give us that opportunity.
I will.
Are there any further comments or questions? Commissioner Walton.
Thank you. I echo the comments of my colleagues. The issue, as we mentioned, is fairly clear in our opinion that the cases that we cleared, the relevant portions of DOMA and constitutional, are stayed right now. And if there was any one of them that was in effect, I think we would all take a real hard look at that one. But we just can't see any area right now where there's a judicial declaration to that effect that's in effect. And so that pretty much ties our hands. But come on back.
Count on it.
Thanks.
If there are no more comments or questions, do we have a motion? Commissioner Walther.
Yes, I move approval of, I'm not sure what was the latest draft number.
I believe it's draft A.
Draft A is modified?
Yes, there have been some suggested edits to draft A in a couple of the footnotes. In footnote 2 on page 2, and I hope we don't have a blue document, but I think we were able to give this on white paper to the press so they'll know what we're talking about. In footnote 2 on page 2 of draft A, there's been a suggestion that we amend the second sentence to read, a contribution from a joint account is attributed in accordance with 11 CFR 110.1K, regardless of the marital status of the contributors, comma, and then quoting from the E&J, since the political committee receiving the contribution may not know whether or not contributors are married, end quote. And then with respect to footnote 3 on page 4, we would replace that with footnote 3 on page 3 of draft B, except deleting the site beginning, see also Perry v. Brown. Those edits.
Yes, that's my motion.
Yes, those edits had been suggested and discussed amongst the commissioners, and that was the last little wrinkle that we were ironing out, which resulted in the two drafts, and I apologize for any confusion that caused. So Commissioner Walther has moved approval of Draft A, Agenda Document 13-15, with the amendments described at the table, and any technical and conforming edits that may be required. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I can almost support the motion. I just have a question about the footnote 3 swap. And this is an issue only lawyers could enjoy talking about, so I apologize to anyone listening in for the real substance of this. But footnote 3 cites Windsor Second Circuit case. The parenthetical says finding Section 3 of DOMA unconstitutional, which, as I understand it, is true. Cert was granted. But then a parenthetical off the cert grant say thereby staying mandate of Second Circuit pending Supreme Court review. Cert granting doesn't stay. Is that, let me ask counsel, is that a correct cite?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. When the Supreme Court grants cert, it automatically stays under Supreme Court procedure.
It does?
Yes.
Okay. Because it stays the mandate. That's why it talks about the mandate.
Right.
Okay. Yeah.
It negates the mandate. The mandate's withdrawn. It stays the case. It stays the decision.
That's okay. So staying the mandate's actually the misnomer. So that's kind of a weird way to to describe that case. Is there, would counsel suggest a way, is that close enough, or is there a more precise way?
It's correct as phrased.
It's close enough. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. I think so.
Any further discussion on the motion? If not, I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Sorry, Mr. Engel. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you all very much for the expedited decision, too.
You always give us interesting questions, Mr. Engel.
Yeah, that's for sure.
We can go to the other AO, or we can go to the ANPRM. I guess we can, since there are probably more people here who are interested in the other AO, why don't we do the AO first? So the next item on the agenda, and we have already, even before it appeared before us, approved consideration of the late submitted document, is Advisory Opinion 2012-38, Socialist Workers Party, Draft C is the new document. Ms. Hayden. No, I'm sorry. Ms. Hemsley.
I'll tell her you were thinking of her.
I was thinking of her,
right,
yes.
Well,
I looked
know.
Down and I saw her name, and then I looked up and I said, but that's not her.
After you said the name,
you didn't look up.
That's not you.
I'd like to say that's not the only person who's ever given me that reaction, Commissioner, but this is not true. So.
My apologies, Ms. Hemsley.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub, and good morning, everyone. Before you in Agenda Documents 1307 and 1307-A, are three draft advisory opinions responding to a request submitted by the Socialist Workers Party asking the Commission to again grant it a partial reporting exemption. Agenda Document 1307 contains drafts A and B, which were submitted for the February 14, 2013 open session, but were held over at the request of the SWP. Draft A would grant the SWP's request for a partial reporting exemption until December 31, 2015. Draft B would deny the request. Agenda Document 1307-A also would grant the partial reporting exemption, but contains revisions to Draft A, including extending the exemption until December 31st, 2016. We received two comments on Drafts A and B, including one from the SWP. Both the commenters were in favor of granting the exemption, and should the Commission approve an advisory opinion, Madam Chair, we request authority to make technical and conforming amendments as necessary. Thank you. We'd be happy to answer questions.
And considering that we were working on the document up until and including after the meeting started, I think that would be a very prudent suggestion that we include technical and conforming amendments. Do we have any, we have counsel in the room if anybody wants to ask them questions. Do we have any questions for our counsel, the requester's counsel, or discussion? Commissioner Walther.
I have questions for counsel.
Okay, come on down.
Good morning.
Good morning. I should start off by saying I was I did not vote in favor of the extension last time, and I just have some questions, if you don't mind helping me out a little bit.
Of course.
My thoughts are pretty much aligned with before, but I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, if I could, about there are a number of other socialist parties that have filed with us for which they've not sought exemption. And I was wondering if you could identify the tenets of the Socialist Worker Party, the requester here, that are principal ones that you feel, or your client feels, are the ones that raise a risk of harassment by either the government or other persons or persons. Is it the tenets that they are currently espoused by the Socialist Workers Party? Is it the history principally, or how do you view the danger at this point to a contributor?
Well, the danger. Good morning, Commissioner, and thank you for your question. Thank you for hearing us. The danger does not come from the tenets of the SWP. The danger comes from, under the Supreme Court precedent, the history of threats, harassment, or reprisals of the SWP combined with the current record of threats, harassments, or reprisals that have been presented to the commission in the intervening 4 years since the last exemption was granted. The tenants themselves do not play a role in the analysis, as far as I understand the reading of the Supreme Court case law and the federal court case law, as well as the commission's own series of advisory opinions on this matter. The tenants of the SWP have been consistent since the 1930s, and you know, have been well known within the population to whom they solicit, to the public, to whom they seek support. But I do not believe that the difference between their tenants and the tenants of other socialist organizations or any other political organizations plays a relevant role in the analysis.
Well, if you humor me a little bit on this, is it the view that it's the history that occurred at the outset where there was a strong negative reaction to some aspect of the Socialist Workers' Party that continues to emanate and cause the same kind of issue? Or certainly if an entity can and decides to change its views on issues, the risk may vary up or down. I mean, you can see now, for example, there's a load of highly negative comments coming out as a result of the gun control litigation issue, not litigation now, but and what, I mean, there's one here that says lawmakers get violent emails over gun control, and so I think in terms of balancing, at least to me, when there is a probability of a risk, we have to take into consideration what is being done to perhaps create that risk. As it, if the tenants are exactly the same as they were before, let me ask you: does the there's only two? There's not been a really a discussion of it before, but they were raised in your letter as being not in the mainstream. There were two issues, as I recall. So it was that's what caught my eye as to the fact that they haven't really had a discussion on it, but it was brought up in your letter. It says, for more than 80 years, both the SWP and the militant have openly called for the establishment of a workers' and farmers' government that will abolish capitalism in the United States and join in the worldwide struggle for socialism. The last hearing we had, we pointed out there was a number of articles, there's even more now, about the fact that socialism is increasingly being discussed in many, many parts of the world, even in our country. Is that a tenet that you contend is out of the mainstream at this point?
Well, I believe 2 points. One is we believe that debates such as Proposition 8 in California, the gun control debate, and any kind of attempt to draw analogies between those types of situations and the situation of the SWP and other minor political parties is misguided, because the gun control debate, Proposition 8 debate, is a debate. Proposition 8 gained more than 7 million votes in California. It drew millions upon millions of dollars of support. It was clearly not a debate that could be characterized as representing a minor party or any kind of view that's outside of the mainstream. If you juxtapose that with the tenets that you described and which we presented in our supplemental submission, you can really see the contrast. And when the Supreme Court put forth the exception to FECA requirements for minor parties, they're really focusing on that. And all of the cases that we've seen, including the cases that deal with the Proposition 8, make clear and explicit exceptions for parties like, and in fact naming the Socialist Workers Party as a party to whom their analysis does not apply. And that's because three central reasons, the analysis that the Commission itself has gone through, that the SWP has a long history of harassment, violence conducted against it, government surveillance, in addition to continuing acts. The second point, which is to address your question maybe a little bit more directly, is that the tenets, as I understand them, of the Socialist Workers Party have remained essentially the same for more than 75 years. And so on the basis of the history of violence, the well-known history of harassment and violence, and the well-known stance that the SWP takes, that's what causes these acts of, that's what continues to cause these acts of harassment and reprisal.
So, but the two points that you make, is then the other one is the call for immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. military forces from Afghanistan, Korea, Guantanamo, naval base in the Pacific, Atlantic, and other oceans, and elsewhere in the world, is the second tenet that you mentioned as being out of the mainstream, as if they were in the mainstream, our analysis could be different. So I raise those for your response. You've already got the votes here, but I did want to dry out and ask you some questions about
that. Sure. And the question specifically is whether or not if the SWP becomes part of the mainstream, if somehow this analysis changes.
Well, you do say these are hardly mainstream positions, as is evident from both the name and content of every issue of the Militant Newsweekly, as well as policies of the Socialist Worker Party itself, as if that was a point that's being raised to support the contention that an exemption is appropriate in this case.
Now, this point was raised.
Understand that?
Yeah, this point was raised to address an issue raised in draft B, of draft B to the advisory opinion, which had dropped a footnote stating that the SWP represents mainstream viewpoints. Because it contains viewpoints of national issues and provides news coverage well within the scope of the national debate. What we had attempted to do in this part of the comments was to demonstrate how clearly unique the SWP's political stance, their positions are, and how different they are from the parties, the main political parties in the United States. That's what we were attempting to do in that part of our comments.
Let me ask you, we have on our records entities called the Freedom Socialist 2012 Presidential Campaign Committee, Democratic Socialists of America, Inc., Socialist National Committee, which is National Party Committee. But in all three instances, there's been no request for an exemption. What separates the Socialist Workers' Party from those entities, if you feel there is a separation in terms of the entitlement to an exemption?
Well, I can't speak to those particular entities because I don't know their history when they were formed, what kinds of records of harassment they have, whether any of that information has ever been public. I will say that the SWP has presented substantial evidence of their own history of harassment, threats and reprisals, both from government parties and from private parties. I can't speak to the difference between other political organizations and the Socialist Workers Party. But the Supreme Court case law doesn't require any particular party to compare themselves to others. They can compare themselves to others if they're a newly formed party and they're trying to find a basis for exemption. They can They can compare their situation to a party that has similar views and has experienced harassment. So if these are newer, any new political party might want to compare themselves to the SWP. But any one party does not have an obligation to distinguish themselves or compare themselves to any other party that has the word socialism in their name or espouses similar ideas.
Let me just mention, it seems to me there seems to be maybe a little more, and I can't tell any degree if it's the case or not, but comments by the members of the Supreme Court on the issue of the importance of disclosure to our system, especially in view of Citizens United, where all sorts of new considerations have arisen for all of us. But we have Justice Sotomayor, Justice Stevens, Justice Ginsburg all saying that in rare circumstances in which disclosure poses a reasonable probability, not a possibility, of serious and widespread harassment that the state is unwilling or unable to control. Would you agree with that as a standard to consider when we determine whether an exemption is appropriate?
I would not consider it appropriate.
Granted, it's only three justices.
I would not consider it appropriate in the context of the SWP for the reason that Citizens United did not address a situation of a minor party. For minor parties, the Supreme Court has been consistent and uniform in their analysis. Evidence of serious instances of threats, harassment, or violence have never been required. The Supreme Court may at some future point develop a different standard for situations such as Prop 8 or gun control debate, which is a debate where there is massive support, a public debate that involves millions of people and millions of dollars, and maybe there's a different standard that the Supreme Court will ultimately apply in that context. But in this context, the context of the SWP and other minor parties, I do not believe that that's relevant now, and should not be considered, at least at this moment, by the Commission going forward, barring some change in the case law.
I appreciate your comments. I have a couple more questions, and then we'll get off it. But I just wanted to give a quote of Justice Scalia, because there's almost five votes at this point. But he says, requiring people to stand up in public for their political acts fosters civic courage, without which democracy is doomed. For my part, I do not look forward to a society which, thanks to the Supreme Court, campaigns anonymously and even exercises the direct democracy of initiative and referendum, hidden from public scrutiny and protected from the accountability of criticism. And then he says, the fact is that running a democracy takes a certain amount of civic courage, and the First Amendment does not protect you from criticism or even nasty phone calls when you exercise your political right to legislate or take part in the legislative process. And I'm sure you know all about those phrases, but in my mind, it does... I think these recent statements cause us to take a look at what was really being thought about, as opposed to an entity that 50 or 70 years ago engaged in conduct that was anathema then, when there's very few people that remember much about it now. I do remember quite a bit, but not 70 years back. I have one more question. In your affidavit, there's a declaration about disclosure in the militant about some people who then wanted you to take it off the online edition of the militant. Can you tell me what the situation was there?
In what respect?
Well, it says, it's from the editor, in the last 5 years since the beginning of 2008, I am familiar with at least five instances where individuals have been quoted in articles in the military posted online, accurately and with their names cited, who have written to the paper to say they have encountered difficulty in getting and maintaining a job because employers have found their quotes in the militant when searching their names on the internet. And are you familiar with those instances?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, what struck me when we look at this is you have the militant just actually disclosing the names of people ostensibly favorable to the tenets in which the militant is writing, And they're not even asking, apparently, the person in advance whether they mind having their names disclosed.
Well, in the context, I understand, in the context of the militant, they might not necessarily be persons who are supportive of the militant or the SWP, but people who are quoted in an article included in the militant, and even including their names in an article in the militant, which editorially supports the SWP, has subjected you know, at least those five individuals to the kind of harassment and discrimination and employment described in the affidavit. So I'm not sure exactly how much more information you need on.
Well, it seems somewhat inconsistent for to make the proposition that the people who make donations do not have to have their name disclosed when they have the right in advance to decide whether or not that's so. But at the same time, the Socialist Workers Party through the militant is apparently just disclosing people's names, knowing that there's a potential risk of harassment occurring to those people.
Well, they're not. Every person quoted in the militant is not necessarily a member or a financial supporter of the militant.
Right.
And so the fact that someone chooses to publicly, in any event, even if someone chooses to publicly associate themselves with the SWP, the fact that when they do so, they're being subjected to harassment, employment harassment, employment negative employment situations, not getting jobs, not getting fired, is, in our view, substantial evidence to support the finding that there's a reasonable probability that other persons, financial supporters of the SWP, will also be subjected to the similar kinds of threats, harassment, and reprisals if their names do become public. So the fact that some people choose to be quoted in an article in the militant or choose to publicly associate themselves with the SWP shouldn't be taken as evidence that somehow the SWP should not be allowed exemption.
Well, in both of the instances you mentioned, they are either inviting and associating themselves with the militant, or making statements to the militant, knowing they might be quoted. But that is not the case here. These are instances in which people have been quoted for whatever reason, and these people apparently had no idea they were being quoted or were going to have any way of being associated with the militant, but yet the militant puts them out into the open in a way that they apparently can predict for the last 5 years might cause them harassment.
Well, they knew that they were going to be quoted in the militant. As with any journalistic enterprise, they're informed that they'll be quoted.
Well, that's inconsistent with these affidavits who say they want their name off the
online version,
yeah,
of the militant.
Well, the press is out. I mean, the press part is already out, so there's nothing they can do about that.
Right, but there's a distinction that they didn't know. The one of the points is that in this day and age, where employers can, it's not so easy for an employer to search every edition of the printed militant when they're going to hire an employee or when they're determining whether or not to punish in some way an employee. You can't, many employers might not have access to the militant, but they can type that employee's name into Google. And if that employee's name appears in the militant online, in some instances, employees have been subject to negative work situations.
So that's a distinction that you draw, is that these people are giving basically consent to be quoted in a written copy of the militant, but not the online version?
That's correct. Okay. Not that they're not giving consent, that they might not necessarily know that the consent to be quoted in an article includes not only a print version of the newspaper, but also an online version.
Well, I want to thank you for your participation here and staying with me on the questions. I appreciate it a lot.
No, thank you very much, Commissioner.
Are there further questions or comments? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. Just to respond briefly to that, even if you have some members or contributors, for our purposes, contributors, because you don't put members on your reports, who are quoted in an article and identified as members of the party, that doesn't affect all the other folks who give money who may not want to be known or for whatever reason feel that they may suffer reprisal of some form. So I understand there's a tension if someone's in a newspaper article but yet claiming that they don't want anyone to know who they are, but I don't see that as what you're arguing. It just, to me, doesn't affect everyone else in the mix. Draft C just came out, and apologize for the lateness. It's similar to other drafts that have been public. I think the goal was to, given that the commission has already issued a number of advisory opinions, streamline this one a little bit. So we took, I think, the less is more approach. Some of the edits, I think, also included some additional facts, and this has been a rather evolving process to make sure we get the facts correct. And I hate to put you on the spot, but part of why we put in the ability of counsel to appear is because usually there's the documents are not publicly available a week before because the deliberation really can't occur until we get to an open meeting. So we put it out. It's a late document. We hope we got it right, but in the event we didn't and you've had a chance to skim it, please feel free to speak up and say, wait, you got something wrong here. But I think the intent was not to hide this from you, but to get it right. The third change from some of the earlier drafts, I think only gave the exemption through the end of 2015, which to me didn't make a lot of sense. It made sense to do it for the whole election cycle 2016, because I can't imagine back in the middle of an election cycle and doing this again. And then if the commission changes its mind, you all of a sudden have to start filing reports in the middle of an election cycle. That just doesn't really work when you take a look at the fact that some of the reporting is tied to sort of election cycle to date kind of numbers. So I don't really have any questions for you other than an open sort of a general question, last opportunity to comment on existing drafts, but I think there's going to be sufficient support for draft C, but any other drafts, and it's just kind of a catch-all. This is your chance to correct the record and see if we got anything glaringly wrong before we do something that we might have to fix.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I was just handed a draft C while sitting at the table here, and so have not had a chance to review it in any manner. But in terms of comments on draft A and B, I believe the SWP was thankfully allowed sufficient time to prepare all of its comments on drafts A and B, and thank the Commission as well as the Office of General Counsel for being flexible in that respect.
Thank you. The idea C was to reflect all that and roll it in. So hopefully
that's very much appreciated.
Hopefully we've done that.
Yes.
I other than a little bit of additional information that was drawn from your comment, I don't think there were any other changes to the facts in draft C. For myself, I share many of my colleagues' concerns about the importance of disclosure, and I agree with all the quotes from various justices that Commissioner Walther read, but I do think that the Socialist Workers Party occupies really a unique place in American history and has a long history that we have to be cognizant of. in addition to this long history of harassment and threats of violence, the commission has a balancing test under the court decisions. The commission must weigh the danger of violence or harassment or threats of violence or harassment directed at the SWP or its supporters against the governmental interest in obtaining identifying information of contributors and recipients of expenditures. And when I look at the SWP and the facts that have been presented, offered a presidential candidate in every election since 1948 and numerous other candidates for federal, state, and local offices, and yet no SWP candidate has ever been elected to public office in a partisan election. Sorry. Data from elections in 2009 to 2012 show very low vote totals for SWP presidential and other federal candidates. Doesn't look like the SWP candidates played the role of a spoiler in any particular election, really have very limited impact on any election in history, as far as we can tell. In addition, information provided by the party indicates that the SWP and its committees and committees supporting its candidates receive very small total amounts of contributions and very low vote totals in partisan elections. Party received only $1,222 from 2009 to 2011 and only approximately $15,500 in 2012. Only 118 people contributed to the committee in 2012, which was even fewer than the 243 people who contributed in 2008, which is what we had before us last time. So the information that is being lost to the public is very, very, very small. There is very little electoral impact of these activities, and there is this long history of harassment and violence. And when I put all those together and do the balance, I think that I come out in favor of what we now have as draft C, despite what I think is a pretty strong record in favor of disclosure. As I said when I started, I think you guys are somewhat unique. So I will be prepared to support draft C with technical and conforming amendments should a motion be offered. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I move adoption of draft C.
The Vice Chairman has moved adoption of draft C, a response to AO 2012-38 to the request of the Socialist Workers Parties as set forth in agenda document number 1307-A, and I understand his motion to include direction to council to do any technical and conforming edits that are necessary.
If I didn't say that out loud, I thought it.
I know you did. I know you did.
Yes, that's part of the motion.
And we all know how good I am at reading your mind, Mr. Vice Chairman. So
I am predictable.
Not always. So that is the motion. Does anybody have any questions or discussions on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion passes 4-1 with the Vice Chairman, Commissioners Hunter Peterson, and myself voting in favor, and Commissioner Walther voting against. Thank you very much.
Thank Council. You, Commissioner. Thank you.
We have one final item on the agenda. A draft advance notice of proposed rulemaking on technological modernization. I should say, by the way, I meant to say this at the beginning, that last Friday the Commission put out a press release summarizing the statistics from the last election with total amounts raised and spent in the vicinity of $7 billion, with breakdowns for various types of committees, including super PACs. In the press release. So if anybody out there has not seen that press release from last Friday, I got a lot of interesting data in it. I recommend it to you. As I said earlier in the year, our numbers come out a little bit different from the numbers that a lot of people quote from Open Secrets, from the Center for Responsive Politics, because they have an army of interns that goes through and takes out I think they call it deduping. They take out the contributions that are passed from one committee to another, which happens, and try and get a sense of how much money overall was in the system. And we do more of just adding up the totals that are raised and spent by the individual committees. So I think they came up up with $6.3 billion. We came up with $7 billion, depending on how you want to count it. Both numbers are accurate. They just represent different things. Having said all that, we will move on to agenda document number 13-14. Ms. Selenkoff.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. The draft advanced notice of proposed rulemaking in agenda document 13-14 requests public comment on whether and how the Commission should revise its rules regarding a variety of technological modernization issues. The Commission is considering whether to revise its regulations to reflect a variety of electronic transactions, such as those made by credit, debit, and gift card, internet-based payment processing, online banking, and text message, among others. Such a rulemaking could address the receipt, deposit, accounting, record keeping, reporting, redesignation, and reattribution of electronic transactions. The Commission is also considering whether to eliminate or update references to outmoded technologies such as telegrams, fax machines throughout the regulations. The draft seeks comments presenting information in particular on general industry practices in the conduct of electronic transactions and record keeping. In particular, how are commercial and consumer electronic transactions conducted? What are industry standards and safeguards generally and for vendors and third-party processors? The draft also seeks information on ways that political committees in particular actually receive electronic contributions and otherwise engage in electronic transactions and record keeping. If the Commission approves the draft ANPRM, the Office of General Counsel seeks authority to make technical and conforming changes to the draft and will submit the draft with any such changes to the Federal Register. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. The notion of updating our regulations to reflect new means of making electronic transactions actually goes back to some what are by now fairly old technologies, including credit cards. That was once a big new deal for the Commission to figure out how to deal with that. But it received a little bit more impetus last year, actually, from Mr. Engel, among others, our previous requester, when we had a number of requests about text messaging and contributions via text messaging. We ended up issuing 6 separate advisory opinions on that, and it seemed like it might be a good idea to see whether it would be beneficial to update our regulations, maybe codify some of the AOs, take a look at some of the technologies that have developed and see whether our regulations are adequate to address them. And we thought rather than starting with a notice of proposed rulemaking, we'd start with an advance notice of proposed rulemaking to try and solicit comment, particularly from those involved in the field who process these contributions, who work with the credit card processors, to make sure that we were covering all the bases and that we weren't missing information when we put out what may result from this, which is a notice of proposed rulemaking. So that was those are some of my goals when I suggested that we did this earlier this year. It's both technical and technological and not very exciting perhaps to some, but maybe we can do some cleanup of our regs and provide a little bit better guidance in the end of the day to folks who are trying to make contributions. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. I'm glad we're doing this. Many of the issues here, although it involves somewhat new technologies, are not particularly new. And I'm glad that we're to this point. The one concern is when you do advance notice of proposed rulemaking, it might be a little too broad, and folks may flounder a little bit on comments, but understand that some of this is not the sort of thing that Federal Election Commissioners necessarily know a lot about. So we are casting a wide net, I think, on purpose. But hopefully folks can help us target, because it'd be a shame if what came back was sort of equally general thoughts. But I'm not sure how we could be more narrow unless we really knew more. So I think it's probably the best way to go. And I'm glad we're here. This is something that some of these issues I confronted before I was appointed, and they've been coming up time and time again, and a number of folks have thought we should have been doing this, and I'm glad that we're now to that point. The Audit Division and the Reports Analysis Division have raised a number of these issues over the years, and here we are, and I'm glad we're tackling this, and I think the text message thing helped bring it into focus for for many that it is a different world. And when you're trying to comply, you run into these issues. And without guidance, it becomes difficult. And I don't think folks should have to dig through a whole pile of AOs and old audit reports to know that, you know, it was an audit report where there was a question whether an email was a signature. And I think in that case we said, well, it was. But then unless you know to dig in that audit report and find maybe a press release, we put out a statement, you know, it really needs to all be an 11 CFR. So you can look at one book, not a series of books, to know how to deal with things that are certainly not on the cutting edge of constitutional law or the scope of the agency's power or any of the things that usually make headlines, but instead the nuts and bolts of how campaigns and those who file reports have to actually do that. And this is hopefully a first step in giving them this sort of clarity that they need, given the fact that they consistently outpace the regulatory agencies from regulating them. And, you know, not that we're trying to regulate them, we're trying to clarify, I think, at least for me. Keep them in line with the statute and, you know, give them what they need so they can go about their business without having to entangle themselves unnecessarily with the commission.
Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am also prepared to support this draft advance notice of proposed rulemaking. Just on the issue of the text messaging, one of the things that commissioners get a chance to do is to speak before many different groups and have the opportunity to get to draw opinions and thoughts from a variety of different people who are either subject to regulation of the commission or who have an interest in this area. And with respect specifically to the text messaging AOs, I've received more than one comment, actually several, saying that this really would be a great area for rulemaking because just as the chair mentioned, a half dozen last year, and there have been a few others that touch upon it, and they're trying to fit the pieces to the puzzle that has been constructed as a result of those AOs sometimes is very confusing, and probably confusing for us. And I can only imagine for those out there trying to put it all together to figure out what they can and can't do. The recommendation was that a rulemaking where you can take a much more comprehensive approach would be very helpful. And so I think that getting information from those who have an interest in this area and to put a little bit more flesh on the bone, as it were, to let us know what that sort of comprehensive regulatory system would look like, I think would be very helpful for us as we consider whether to take the next step in the rulemaking process. But as I said, I'm prepared to support this.
I think that the challenge, particularly when we're dealing with technology, is how to clarify how the law applies to conduct without being overly prescriptive, because technology is developing all the time, and we don't want to write regulations that are going to limit people from being innovative as new technologies do develop. So I would encourage people out there who have suggestions on how we might best do that to send us comments on that, too. Any further discussion? Commissioner Walter?
Just to join my colleagues on this, I think it's great to, you know, compliment the chair for bringing this before us, and I hope that it will translate into a rulemaking.
Wouldn't that be exciting?
We can get at least 4 votes on.
Anybody want to make a motion?
I move adoption of the document, which I don't have exactly handy. So you
and document 13-14?
Yeah, that's the one. And I don't think we don't have any changes to it, so.
Commissioner Walther has moved adoption of agenda document number 13-14, draft advance notice of proposed rulemaking on technological modernization, and authorizing counsel to make any technical and conforming edits. Is there any discussion on the motion? I will call the question. All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. Mr. Staff Director, are there any management or administrative matters that we need to discuss today?
Madam Chair, there are none.
In that case, everybody enjoy Take Your Kids to Work Day, and this meeting is adjourned.